Okay, so it's wonderful to have the opportunity to do a little learning with you this evening, and especially wonderful to have the opportunity to learn about the Rama, Rav Moshe Isserles, who figures so prominently in the life of Ashkenazic Jewry. So just to kind of quickly recap some of what we've talked about over the last couple weeks, we introduced the figure of Rabbi Yosef Karo, and just to sort of place everyone chronologically and geographically, we're in the middle of the 16th century. Rabbi Yosef Karo is born circa 1488 and dies in 1575, spends most of his life in the Ottoman Empire, a Spanish exile. 1522. This is the 500th anniversary of the year that he began writing his Beit Yosef, which was completed in around 1550. And we talked about both his extensive and expansive and revolutionary work, the Beit Yosef, and the Shulchan Aruch, which was in many ways a kind of condensed version intended to be a work that could be universally read and universally accepted as the authoritative codification of Jewish law for all people, all Jewish people in all places for all time, which is really quite stunning. We talked about the importance of it being printed in Venice and it being conceived of in the Holy Land. If there are any questions or comments, I'm happy to field them at the end with respect to Rabbi Yosef Karo. So it's in that context that I want to think about and introduce the figure of Rav Moshe Isserles. And what I'd like to do tonight is spend a little time talking about his background and his biography, what his relationship may have been or may not have been with Rabbi Yosef Karo as an individual, and then talk about what it is that the Rama, Rav Moshe Isserles, contributed to the life of the Shulchan Aruch specifically, which we'll talk about. If we have time, and this might be too ambitious, but if we have time, we'll talk about what it means to be Ashkenazic. We throw around this term, right? But do we ever stop to define it? What is an Ashkenazic Jew? What makes you or me or anyone else that we know a member of the Ashkenazic community such that we would somehow have some special relationship to the Rama or anyone that he's purportedly writing for? And hopefully at the end, again, provided there's time, we'll see the Rama in action by just coming back to some kind of everyday halachos that pertain to Hanukkah, so we can get a flavor for how the Rama actually works. Okay, so we shift our focus when we talk about Rabbi Yosef Karo. We're in the Ottoman Empire for the better part of his life. We're in Tzfat, we talk about the Rama. We're in Krakow. Okay. I'm sure many of you have been to Krakow and have visited the Rama's synagogue and visited the Rama's grave, which I'll bring up in just a moment. The Rama's date of birth, the year of his birth, is not known precisely to us, but we assume it's around 1530. The only problem with that date is that it makes him very, very young when he assumes positions of authority, which it could be. He was quite an extraordinary person. But as we'll see, it's possible that he was born prior to 1530. So again, all of this is in kind of thumbnail form. But what are Jews doing in Poland in the 16th century? How did they get there? Where did they come from? So, as you know, by this point in Jewish history, Jews have been expelled from many Western European countries, including France and Britain, and they're moving east. And the Jewish community in Poland, you know, we can sort of date it to 1500 or thereabouts. And of all the small communities in Poland, Krakow is maybe the most important among them. Okay, his father is a very wealthy and very prominent member of the Krakow Jewish community, and this is the family into which little Moshe Isserles is born. Okay. He studied. We don't know too much about his early life, but we do know that he studied in Lublin under a man called Rabbi Shalom Shachnow, who's not well known because he left us almost no writings, and quite intentionally so. But his students were very well known because among them were the Rama and the Maharshal, Shlomo Luria, who we'll talk about in a later session, as well as Chaim Ben Bezalel, who we'll come back to in just a few moments. Okay, so at around the age of 20, and again, it would make him very young, but around the age of 20 in 1550, the Rama returns to Krakow and sets up a shul, or becomes the rabbi of an existing shul. He sets up a yeshiva, and this is almost without precedent, but he privately supports his students because he can. So typically, the yeshiva students are supported by their families or their community, or this, depending on when and where, various structures for how yeshiva students are supported. But in this case, they're actually supported by the head of the yeshiva, the Rosh Yeshiva himself, the Rama. In 1533, he is appointed to be a dayan, and he also served, and this could be its own session, but he also served on the Council of Four Lands, the Vad Arba Aratzot, which was a kind of supra-communal legal body that was semi-autonomous and governed the Jews of these regions in the 16th, 17th, and even into the 18th century. Okay, in addition to being a Talmud scholar, Moshe Isserlis is also a Kabbalist, and it's also known that he studied philosophy and history and astronomy. I'll just say, because it's kind of timely, and some of this was going around during the pandemic, in 1556, there was an epidemic that ravaged Krakow, and Moshe Isserlis had to flee to Lach, I don't know how possibly to pronounce it. It's something like Sydlowice, Szydlowiec. Any Polish speakers, feel free to correct my pronunciation. And during this plague, he actually writes a book on Megillas Esther. He calls it Mechir Yayin, and in his introduction, he says, maybe literally, maybe figuratively, but you know, I can't give Shalach Manos this year because it's a plague, so I'm giving this book. Okay. So he's not just a rabbi, but he really becomes, even though he lives a relatively short life, again, assuming he's born in 1530, dies in 1572. So it's really quite remarkable to think of what he accomplished in that short time. But he achieves a kind of renown that makes him the authority for Ashkenazic Jews, certainly in Poland and beyond. I'll just bring up the image because we have it, you know, thanks to the ravages of history. Many cases, prominent rabbis' graves are no longer extant. In the case of Rabbi Moshe Isserlis, we have his tombstone. And again, I'm sure many of you were there. It's in the little section of Kazimierz, which is the kind of Jewish quarter of Krakow. You can see the Rama Shul, and you can see the Rama's grave. So I'll just share with you a couple lines from the tombstone, which again is clearly legible. Ner Hamaravi Hagaon Hagadol Bidoro Morenu Moshe Roa Evin Yisrael. Okay, so here is interred the light of the nation, Ramosha Israelis, who was the shepherd of the Jewish people. When did he die? Biyom, we don't say it this way anymore. We would say Lamed Gimel, but Biyom Gimel Lamed Lemispar B'nei Israel. It's a play on words. But his anniversary of his death, his yahrzeit, is on Lag BaOmer. So if you just skip down to the end of the fourth line, is a kind of pun, mi Moshe v'ad Moshe lo kam ki Moshe b'Yisrael. So it used to be said about the Rambam that from Moshe to Moshe, from Moshe Rabbeinu until Moshe ben Maimon, until Maimonides, lo kam Moshe b'Yisrael. There was no other, you know, such a person. There was no other Moshe of whom to speak. And so it's quite stunning that this formulation would get reformulated to honor Moshe Isserlis. Okay, so he's in the company of Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe ben Maimon, the Rambam, and now standing next to those pillars is Rav Moshe Isserles. Okay, so really, really a stunning formulation, and it's obviously not by accident that he achieves this this acclaim. Okay, so what was his relationship with Rabbi Yosef Karo? And again, I've sort of tongue in cheek a little called this series Rabbi Yosef Karo and His Friends. Whether or not Rabbi Yosef Karo actually had a personal relationship with some of the people that we're talking about on the page of the Shulchan Aruch and in the annals of Jewish history, we group them together, and this becomes a kind of becomes a kind of chevra. So sometimes people actually have a mistaken belief that there was a correspondence between Rav Moshe Isserles and Rabbi Yosef Karo. So just remember the dates for a second. Rav Yosef Karo and Rav Moshe Isserles overlap in their adult lives, but Rav Yosef Karo is 42 years older than Rav Moshe Isserles. Okay, so he is he's already the kind of Gadol Hador when Moshe Isserles is born, right? So he's a whole generation, maybe even a generation and a half older. And even when Moshe Isserles achieves acclaim, so Yosef Karo is even more acclaimed. So there is this one kind of a correspondence, and I'll just sort of say parenthetically, it was not uncommon when collections of responsa came out for the authors of those responsa to include responsa of their colleagues. Okay, so Rav Moshe Isserles has a responsa. People write to him from his community, from all over the world, and they say, "I have a question. Can you give me halachic guidance on X, Y, or Z?" And Rav Moshe Isserles responds, and he collects them, and they are published as a set of responsa. In addition, sometimes a person asking the question would say something to the effect of, "I asked this question to so and so, and I got the following response. How do you feel about it?" Right? And sometimes they were shopping, and sometimes they were trying to get a fuller picture. Sometimes it functioned as an appeal. And again, this is part of a larger conversation. But we have one such kind of quote unquote correspondence between Rav Moshe Isserles and Rabbi Yosef Karo. And because both tshuvos appear next to one another in the Shu't Ramah, it's sometimes easy to make the mistake that, oh, Rav Moshe Isserles is a letter here. It says Yosef Karo. I guess they were writing to each other. No, they weren't writing to each other. And I'll just share it with you. It's sources 2 and 3 on your sheet. If you have it, I won't put it up on the screen. Just in the interest of time, in source number 2, the Ramah quotes a question and answer that he received. It was known to him. A question that was sent to Rabbi Yosef Karo, and someone forwards the response to Rabbi Yosef Karo. The case was not a particularly dramatic case. Someone had passed away, and he had left in his will instructions for part of his estate to be dispersed to his heirs and part of the estate to be dispersed to the indigent community, indigent Jews of Israel. And the heirs put up a stink, and they said, "Oh, it was mishandled, and there's a problem with the will. And it wasn't directed properly. And in fact, the will should be, sort of set aside. All the money should come to us, the heirs, and none of it should really be portioned to tzedakah, that we shouldn't activate the will." And Rabbi Yosef Karo writes back and he says, no, the will was fine. And the money that was intended to go to the poor people in Israel really should be directed to the poor people in Israel." And then I'll just share with you, Moshe Isserles gets this, back and forth, and he responds, and he actually has a different opinion, and he says, "No, I actually side with the heirs." But again, sort of the content aside, just listen. We don't have dates for this, but presumably, both of them are adults. Obviously, Yosef Karo is 42 years older, so the Ramah is writing about his much senior colleague. He says in source number 3, "Bati lahashiv mimei hakavod lidibur ha'gaon ha'gadol marenu v'rabbeinu Rabbi Yosef Karo." Okay, I was asked to opine on this opinion, which was printed or written by Rabbi Yosef Karo. Asher, and now here's how he described Rabbi Yosef Karo. Asher Meimav Anu Shosim Mikan Kano Vekado, right? We just we drink the feed of his wisdom. Ma Usif Bishivcho Lechabdo. What could I possibly add to his praise? Miachar de Kolmad de At Mishabeach Le At Megane Bemase, right? We could never heap on enough praise to this extraordinary man. Yibarcheu Hashem benafsho umeudo, he should be blessed. Viosoki achar hashebach ra'u liyosa tfila, and it's kind of a play on words based on the Talmudic principle that after you praise someone, you should pray for them. So after the shebach should come the tfila. So he says, okay, nespele el Hashem, el hasid. So I also want to give a bracha to Rabbi Yosef Karo, la'arich yimei morenu v'rabenu nesi elokim besochenu, timely, because we just had that expression in our parsha. He should be blessed with long life. What a divine prince in our midst, ushnosav betov uneimim levalos ad b'shuv Hashem shivat zion yiru einav ve'einenu. He should continue to illuminate us. Okay, tremendous respect and deference for the authority of Rabbi Yosef, Kahn. Okay, so with that background in mind, let me just say a couple words about the literary output of Rabbi Yosef of Moshe Isserles in his lifetime. Okay. So arguably the two most important works, and they're the works that we'll focus on in a moment, are the Darkei Moshe and his glosses to the Shulchan Aruch. Okay, so we'll circle back to those in a moment. In addition to those halachic works, he also wrote the Toras Chatas, which was a legal guidebook on kashrus, the Toras Ha'ola, which was a philosophical explanation of the significance of the temple in Jerusalem, Mechir Yayin, which I mentioned he wrote during the plague, which was a commentary on the book of Esther, on the Megillah, the Tshuvos HaRama, the excerpts of which we just saw, it's a collection of 132 responsa, about 100 of which were written by him, and a number of other glosses to existing works. So the primary work that I want to focus on this evening is the Darkei Moshe. So I just want to share with you some excerpts from the introduction to the Darkei Moshe, because they tell us everything that you need to know about this book. So again, just to put things in context and to remind you, in 1550, Rabbi Yosef Karo had published in print, it's a new technology, Rabbi Yosef Karo had published in print the book that he had been working on for 28 years, okay, started in 1522, the Beit Yosef. I say it that way because even though in yeshiva I used to call it the Beis Yosef, but I'm sure Rabbi Yosef Karo would have called it the Beit Yosef. So he spent 28 years writing this book, which is a commentary to the Torah, okay, a commentary to the Torah. So some point after 1550, Rav Moshe Isserles is working on this book called the Darkei Moshe, and he tells us about it. Okay, and if you have it, it's in the source sheet. It's source number 4. I'll just put up a couple of excerpts in a moment. So he says, you know, I just want to let you know, it's the bolded section of the introduction to the Darkei Moshe in source 4. He says, I just want to let you know that it was always my practice to learn very comprehensively, to study the text sort of from beginning to end. And I would work on the Gemara with the Gaonim and the Rif and Tosfos and the Rambam and all of the individual commentaries that we would call the Rishonim, the Mordechai and the Tur and Tosfos. And so on. And I would try to, you know, then review the later halachic works from 13th, 14th, 15th centuries. And I tried to synthesize them. And he says, my goal, my intention was to collect everything that I had worked on and to write a commentary. My goal was to attach it to a book. And this was always the practice in Ashkenaz. They were not in the habit, the Ashkenazim were not in the habit of, in this time, were not in the habit of writing independent works or independent texts. They wrote commentaries to, glosses to existing texts. So he says, it was my dream to attach my Perush to an existing commentary And there's no better book to attach it to than The Tour. Sound familiar? Very familiar, because this is functionally what Rabbi Yosef Karo says in his introduction to the Beit Yosef. Here's my plan, a code, something comprehensive, something that's all-inclusive, something that reflects all the scholarship before, during, and after the tour. And I'm going to synthesize it for you. I'm going to evaluate it for you, and I'm going to make a conclusion for you. So the Rama writes that, I had this idea to write this comprehensive commentary to the tour, but then something happened, and I'll put it up on the screen. He writes so beautifully and so poetically. Everything is a co-option of a pasuk from Tanakh or a phrase from the Gemara, and there's not really any way to translate it without losing the depth and the breadth and the allusions and the beauty of this text. And it's much richer to see it in the original. So he says, I love this line. It's like, who talks this way? It's amazing. He says, "Uvehagia Tor Esther, Rotzelomer Isser Beheter." It's a pasuk from the Megillah. Something happened suddenly, right? It was Esther's turn. So he says, "Isser Beheter." So he says, "I got up to Isser Beheter. I was writing a commentary. There's four sections of the Torah, and I was writing on Yoredeh. The Hischalti Hilchos Challah, and I got up to Hilchos Challah." And Achazni Platzos Ulavshani Chalchala. And I almost fell off my chair. Bishami Ner Yisrael Rosh HaGola Ari Mispachoala Al HaShamayim V'ruach Elokim Kadishin BeChefseinu Asaf V'chiber Sefer Beit Yosef. I got word that the Gadol Hador, Rabbi Yosef Karo, wrote a book called the Beit Yosef. Asher kol ro'av yodin es malaso ves tovo v'rov tov hatzafon v'kirbo. It's like, you're turning your doctoral dissertation into a book, and you're getting ready to submit it, and you're all excited, and you get a message. Somebody just published a book with the Harvard University Press, and it just happens to be the most important person in the field. And you're devastated. Well, I can't hold a candle. What am I possibly going to contribute that he beat me to the punch? And it's not just another person beat me to the punch. The person who beat me to the punch is Rabbi Yosef Karo. And again, Rabbi Yosef Karo in Krakow, they know all about Rabbi Yosef Karo in Tzfat, right? It's not a secret. World renowned, Gadol Hador. He's like, oh my gosh. Well, it's like, I'm totally devastated, and I thought v'shiagati larik shinasi gazalti. I'm like, I spent how many hours and I lost all this sleep, and it's for nothing, because it obviously Rabbi Yosef Karo's work is going to be 100 times more. And he's not saying it out of false modesty. He's saying it because Rabbi Yosef Karo is Rabbi Yosef Karo. I can't possibly. What could I do? So he says, I was totally devastated, and I didn't know what to do. And he goes on and he says, then I thought about it some more, and I thought, actually, I do have something to contribute. And I'm not exactly sure the timing when he saw the Beit Yosef in the interim, but clearly he got a hold of it. And at some point shortly thereafter, he decided, I've not been wasting my time. What I'm going to do is abandon my project to write a commentary on the Torah, and instead I'm going to use everything I've collected and write a commentary to the Beit Yosef. And he says, I have to do that for a couple of reasons, one of which is because there are sources which are just not included in the Beit Yosef that I need to include. And let me just share one more excerpt. This is surely the most important excerpt in his introduction to the Darkei Moshe. He says, "Hashlishis vehu ha'ikar." Okay, the third reason why I made this decision to write this book and to publish this book and to write this commentary to the Beit Yosef is the following. He says, "Vuatachlis amrukash b'zeh mefkar." Ki yadu asharav machaber Beit Yosef betivo el hagdolim nichsa. So everybody knows, right? We talked about this a couple weeks ago. Everyone knows how the Beit Yosef is structured. Upsak halacha b'chol makom api shnei u'shlosha edim. So he says, everyone knows this, right? The Beit Yosef took the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rosh, the three major authorities from the medieval period, and he assembled them. Harif, Al Rambam, Al Rosh, b'chol makom sheshnayim ahem ladas achas nitzbadim u'lishar revusa adira hetorah lo chashalim. So it's a little bit of an exaggeration because Rabbi Yosef Karo said, you know, I first turned to the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rush, and if there's ever a dispute, I'll follow the majority. If two out of three of them agree, that's how I will conclude. We should paskin. That will be the halacha. And he says a second tier, and he says, and if it's indecisive or someone doesn't have an opinion or it's one against one, so I'll look toward other. The second tier of Rishonim. So it's a little bit of an exaggeration, the Rama says. But the Rama says, I can't accept this notion that you're just going to look to those three and ignore everyone else. Rak b'makom gedolim amad lipsok halacha kedivrei shneihem. V'af ki hem kamai v'lo basrai v'lo chash l'dvarim shetzafu bo kamai d'kamai. He says, I have another problem. And this is a very important point, and again, part of a much larger discussion. I'll just mention it in passing. The Ashkenazim were dedicated to the proposition of Hilchasa Kebasrai, which is a Talmudic principle. And there's some debate whether or not it applies only to Talmudic debates or whether or not it should be extended further. The Ashkenazim held that it should be extended further. What does Hilchasa Kebasrai mean? Hilchasa Kebasrai means when there's a debate, and again, you have to figure out what constitutes a debate, but all things being equal, when there's a debate, we're going to follow the later authority because the later authority has the benefit of hindsight. So recency matters. So it's not so different in the world of scholarship, right? So a scholar writing in 2022 has the benefit of all the scholarship that came before. So presumably it's going to be richer and more comprehensive and more thought through than scholarship from 1822, right? So the halachic system, according to the Ashkenazim, is built on this notion of Hilchasa Kebasrai. He says, the Beis Yosef didn't do that. He threw that out the window. I want to resuscitate that principle and include, right, the later poskim that the Rabbi Yosef Karo just ignores. Okay. Halo Arif Shapasak Sof Perak Beis the Erevin Piskimu Murabim Misok Alacha B'chol Makom Kevas Rivalo Lachush L'Divrei Kamai. He says, and I'll tell you even more. The Rif himself says you should do that. Okay. Ve'afilu B'makom Harav Eitz Latam V'chein Pasuk Achronu Tami. You have all these posts can say Hilchasa Kebasrai, Hilchasa Kebasrai. We can't just ignore that principle. Asher behem eiru kol machshoch vegilo kol talamus. Vayedeze adavar seiser kol aminagim asher be'elo medinos. And this is the second point, which is maybe even more decisive for the Rama. He says, as a result of Rabbi Yosef Karo's insistence on following two of the three giants, Rambam, Rif, and Rush, he says, what have you sacrificed? You've sacrificed local custom. And again, this is going to happen with any attempt at codification. If you're trying to make a universal law, what that means is you've then flattened all the differences, right? So I have my minhag about, what I do at the Seder, and you have your minhag. Yosef Karo is saying, too bad, one rule for everyone. And Moshe Isserles jumps back. He says, you can't do that. Minhag matters, right? Now we have to figure out what he says. Asher be'elu hamedinos. We have our minhagim. He says, Yosef Karo, very nice. You wonderful, gaonic, amazing, knowledgeable, reverent, Sephardic posek writing in Tzfat. Shkoach, that's wonderful. But what about us Ashkenazim in Krakow? We have our own minhagim. So someone needs to preserve them and make sure that they are not they're not lost. So he says, that'll be my responsibility. I'll come along, and where the Beit Yosef just flattens the landscape, I'm going to come and build it back up and remind everyone with a gloss that says, no, just one second. What we do here is actually a little different. Not because I think I know better, but because there's something missing from the landscape. These precious minhagim that I'm trying to defend, asher rubam binuyam al haklal hazeh bepshitus v'tzimimus, ve'ein mefakvim achar divrahim. No one has any dispute about them. These are well established and well accepted. I don't want to mess with them. And that's why I put in a little note that says, this is how we practice, right? And these are the ways of my people. And I says, I always try to give attribution. If it's not for me, I want you to know who it's from. And if I write nearly, you'll know it's for me. But otherwise, I'm telling you, it has an earlier source. It's an amazing piece of humility here. And he actually means it. He says, he says, and if I'm guilty of making a mistake, it's on me, right? Don't attribute it to anyone else. Don't hang it on anyone else. If there's an error, the error is exclusively me. So this is the Darkei Moshe. And the Darkei Moshe is the Ashkenazic parallel to the Beit Yosef, which again attempts to say we have something richer, we have something fuller, we have our minhagim, we have our Ashkenazic poskim, and Rabbi Yosef Karo, we all bow to your authority, but someone needs to preserve the local minhagim and the Ashkenazic practices that you, Rabbi Yosef Karo, too blithely ignore. Okay, let me pause here and just ask, I know I've said a lot, but let me just ask if there are any questions or comments before I introduce the mapa. Mark.
Just one question. Was this prevalent during this time of codification of the rules where Yosef Karo would have expected that there was going to be a quote-unquote Ashkenazic response to anything that he published?
That is a great question. I'm not sure that it's possible to know the answer. I'll say just a couple of comments. Some like bigger picture historians have pointed out that it's an age of codification. Okay? So, and again, it's not my area, but academics much wiser than I have noted that if you look at the history of jurisprudence in England, So it's right around the 16th century that codification is getting going, right? And if you look at Islamic sources from the Ottoman Empire in the 16th century, wouldn't you know it, there's codification going on in, you know, big cities in the Ottoman Empire. So I don't think it would have surprised anyone for there to be another attempt at codification. And next week, when we talk about the reception of the Shulchan Aruch, we're going to talk extensively about how the Shulchan Aruch was received and other attempts at codification, which maybe were less successful, as we know historically, but you know they didn't know that in the moment. So that's the first observation I'll make, is that I don't think it would have surprised anyone for there to be other attempts at codification. The only other thing I'll just mention in passing is, it's my contention, again, not the first one to make this case, but it's my contention that Rabbi Yosef Karo was really attempting something that no one had ever attempted before, and that was to write a universally applicable code. And we talked a little bit about it last time. You know, why did he include the Zohar? Because there were communities in Greece that were really receptive to the Zohar, and he wanted to make sure that they felt like this was a text that they could read. You know, and why did he include some of the Ashkenazic poskim, because he wanted this to be in the hands of the Ashkenazic Jews, and he wanted them to feel like this was a text they could read. So whether he anticipated that someone like the Rama would come along and add these glosses isn't known to me, but I also suspect that it wouldn't have been crazy to imagine that this was coming. Okay, so let me just say one more word about the other text that the Rama wrote that made him famous, and that was called colloquially the Mapa. Okay, and again, everything's a pun. It all comes from the language of the Mishkan, as the Torah describes the Mishkan. So you have a Shulchan Aruch, you have a set table. So the Rama writes a commentary which he calls the Mapa. This is going to be the table cover. Okay, so it's beautiful. It's all set. It's great, but it needs a cover. So the Dark King Moshe, of which there were actually two versions, a longer and a shorter one, because he had to go back and rewrite it once the Beit Yosef had been published. So the Dark King Moshe is kind of the commentary to the Beit Yosef, and it's works in tandem with the Beit Yosef. And then, as we talked about last time, Rabbi Yosef Karo wrote, whether or not they were meant to be studied together, a much shorter, condensed version of just the basic bottom line. It wasn't really always the bottom line. Sometimes he says there's two opinions and you're left wondering what is the bottom line. But principally, right, the much condensed version of the Beit Yosef is the Shulchan Aruch. And likewise, the much condensed version of the Darkei Moshe is the Ramah. If you ever see a one-line comment of the Ramah, you're wondering, well, where did that come from? So it's not a secret. You can go back, you pull out, it's now published together with the Torah and the Beit Yosef. You pull out the Torah and the Beit Yosef, you open up to the Darkei Moshe, you'll have an essay, right? It's not one line, it's 10 lines. And he'll tell you what the sources are, and he'll tell you what his thinking is. Now, it's not a one-to-one correspondence. There might be time where this comment in the Darkei Moshe is absent from the Mappah, or vice versa, but principally, it's the piece that matches up with the Shulchan Aruch. And I'll just show you, it's not the only work that looks like this, so it's not decisive, but I also don't think it's an accident. This is published much later, but if you look at the Darkei Moshe, and again, it's the Darkei Moshe, it's not the Mappah, but if you look at the border of this text, looks surprisingly like a tablecloth. Right. Okay. And that was, of course, the association that people would have had with the Ramah, that the Shulchan Aruch is the table and the Mappah is the tablecloth. Okay. So I'll just say one kind of additional note about the primacy of Minhag. The primacy of Minhag is obviously an animating feature of the Ramah's book and the Ramah's commentary. He's not the author of that view. He's the mouthpiece of that view for many, many generations in Ashkenaz, certainly dating at least as far back to the Tosafists. Minhag was enormously important and enormously influential. And you get phrases like Minhag Yisrael Halacha and Minhag Mevatel Halacha, like Minhag, the way that our forefathers had been doing things is decisive. Okay? And some of the academics have a nice formulation to paraphrase, right? It can't be that our ancestors got it wrong, right? Our ancestors were pious and knowledgeable and religious. And if you accept that as the premise, then the Masorah that we receive from them is the right Masorah because they were pious and religious. So what are you telling me? That they made a mistake? That they didn't know what they were talking about? It can't be. I mean, if you accept the premise that these people were pious, then the Masorah that we've received in the form of the Minhag that we're practicing must be right. Now, of course, you get chinks along the way, and sometimes you have dislocations, and things could be thrown into a state of upheaval. But I'll just share something I once heard from Rabbi Mintz, which I think is actually a kind of fascinating footnote to this conversation. He said that in Tzvat, right, Rabbi Yosef Karo, and this fits with the model that I tried to formulate a couple weeks ago, Rabbi Yosef Karo is trying to universalize. He's trying to, the purpose of his code is to say, I'm not actually interested in, what you happen to do in your little community. This is the code. This is the right way to do it. And you should do it. The Polish Jews for whom the Ramah is writing, right, are scattered, and they're worried about being further scattered. And the thinking about ways to preserve, right, the non-uniformity. So it's codification for the sake of preservation, as opposed to Yosef Karo's codification for the sake of universalization, to the extent that that's a word. Okay. So I want to shift gears for a moment and actually throw it out to you if anyone is interested in answering this question. What, and forgive me if anyone on this call is not a member of the Ashkenazic community, what makes you an Ashkenazic Jew, right? If you identify as an Ashkenazic Jew, why? Right? It's not a trick question, but what makes you or any of us Ashkenazi?
Geography.
Okay, so geography. So Vicky says geography. So I'll just throw it back a little and say geography only gets you halfway home. So where is Ashkenaz? What is Ashkenaz? Let's just say for, you know, argument's sake that it refers to Germany. So I'm living in New York City. I'm not living in Germany. So what makes me Ashkenazic?
Tradition,
Ellie says. So what do you mean by that?
Well, you would say minhagim or something that's brought down from your parents, the way they operated, the way that they prayed, the way that it's basically a form of life.
Okay, so I would say your answer is genealogy. I'm Ashkenazic because my parents were Ashkenazic, right? Irrespective of where they were from or how many dislocations they suffered. So I just want to share with you the kind of complexity and ambiguity of a question that we hardly ever think about and the answer to which we too often take for granted. I didn't put it on the source sheet, but it's fascinating to know that Yosef Karo had a very specific answer to this question. He was once asked by the Jews of Pleven. I don't think Pleven is on the map anymore, but it's not actually far from Nicopolis, where he lived in present-day Bulgaria. There were Jews who had emigrated from Ashkenaz to Pleven, and they wanted to know whether or not they should keep their minhagim or accept the minhagim of the community, which was obviously a community of Sephardic exiles. And Rabbi Yosef Karo said, "You're in Pleven now. You are not in Ashkenaz anymore, right? Dorothy, you're not in Kansas anymore. This is Pleven. So I'm sorry, but it's over. You were exiled. Now you have to act like the rest of us. We have a community here." He wasn't living in Pleven, but you have to act like the Plevenites, right? That's what you should do. So this actually comes to, you know, Vicky's first answer, which is geography, but you have to kind of freeze the picture. It's geography in its moment. And if you change the geography, then you change your identity. And that's kind of one answer to this question. There's another answer, which I have for you in source number six. In the interest of time, I'll just summarize it. And this is you know, Ellie's answer. And that comes from a man called Rabbi Jacob Castro in a book called the Erech Lechem, where he was actually asked whether and to what extent the cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom should apply if people have left the areas in which Rabbeinu Gershom had lived. So Rabbeinu Gershom said, there's a ban on polygamy, you can't do that anymore. But, you know, who accepted that cherem? The people who lived in the communities where he propagated that cherem. So the Erech Lechem says, no. If you come from that community, you are subject to that ban. Right? What makes you Ashkenazic is the fact that you have Ashkenazic ancestors who we would attribute Ashkenazic identity to. Yeah, Vicky.
Isn't that where you get minhag ha-makom?
Yeah, so that's a huge question and a huge conversation, which maybe I'll table for another time. But really, a big open question: whether and to what extent minhag ha-makom can change and can be picked up and transferred to another location. Just to give the kind of, you know, headline, there's a debate about the question to begin with. And what's going to matter is, did you get dislocated as a community? Right? Your whole community had to flee, and now, right, you're the XYZ community, you know, the Luxembourg community in New York City. Or you came in dribs and drabs and you happen to just be a single family, a single person, and, you know, in which case maybe you can't say you're bringing the community with you. But a big question. Okay, I'll just share with you, and this is really, I think, fascinating. This is the title page to one of the earlier editions. I think the first edition of the Darkei Moshe was published in, or the first edition of the Mapa was published in 1570 in Krakow. This is a 1593 edition. I just found it clearer to read. I don't remember the name of the publisher. It wouldn't be known to us. It doesn't really matter. But the publisher took it upon himself to answer the question that everyone is wondering. And it's quite actually amazing. The Rama uses the word Ashkenaz in his commentary, right, which is tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of words. He uses it 10 times. He almost never says that word. He just says Medinot Elu. He says what we do in these lands. So we have to answer the question, what lands is he referring to? What is he talking about? So the publisher took it upon himself to answer the question. And he says, I'm publishing, right? And again, the glosses of the Rama are published together with the Shulchan Aruch. We'll talk more about why that's so important next week. But he publishes this book and he says, I have the commentary of the Shulchan Aruch by the codification of the Shulchan Aruch by Rabbi Yosef Karo. And then I have the glosses by a man called Rabbi Moshe Isserles. Okay. And now look what he adds. He says, Marenu V'Rabenu Haga'on Moshe Isserles Zatzal Imora Tzedek Minhag Kilot Kidoshot Kidoshim. And now he gives you names. He says he's writing for the following communities: Poland, Rysen, which I think is Russia, Lita, Lithuania, Piha, which I think is Bohemia, Marin, which is Moravia, V'Ashkenaz, which is Germany. So he just gave you the list. So is that the list? And if I'm not living in one of those six locations, I'm not Ashkenazic. I wasn't represented by the, by the commentary of the Rama. It's a real open question. Let me just share with you two final sources on this question. And we're not going to solve it, but I'm going to leave it a little unsolved, but it's fascinating to see that it's unsettled. There's a very important work called Vikuach Mayim Chaim, which was written by Chaim ben Bezalel, known as the brother of the Maharal of Prague. Okay, and he was a contemporary, exact contemporary of the Rama. And he was very upset by the publication of the Rama's works for a number of important reasons. Okay, and I have it for you in source number 7. In the interest of time, I'll just share with you the translation of Joseph Davis. Many of these sources that I've shared with you in the last 6 minutes are referenced in a very important article by Joseph Davis called The Reception of the Shulchan Aruch, which was written around 20 years ago. I'm happy to share it with you, or you can find it online. Just Google Joseph Davis, The Reception of the Shulchan Aruch, if it's of interest. This is the translation of Vikuach Mayim Chaim, Reb Chaim ben Bezalel, brother of the Maharal, polemicizing against the Rama. And what emerges from his polemic against the Rama is a definition of Ashkenaz. Listen to what he says. He says, there's a great need to assert the differences between the customs of the Jews of Germany, B'nai Ashkenaz, and those of the land of Poland. Rabbi Isserles himself, in his introduction to Taras Chatas, did not mention the customs of Germany at all, but only those of his own land. The introduction of the proofreader, however, mentioned explicitly, he had a slightly different list, but we just saw this, Poland, Ukraine, Bohemia, Moravia, and he extended the borders even farther and wrote, in perhaps every place where German, Lashon Ashkenaz, probably means Yiddish, where Yiddish is spoken. So by the way, there's another definition of Ashkenaz in there, which is Yiddish-speaking lands. One may see that he expressed uncertainty whether the book applies to German Jews, B'nai Ashkenaz, or not. He being the publisher, right, who wrote those geographic place names in the title page. So the printer added that on his own and mentioned Germany as well on this title page so that he would increase his sales in all those lands, because buyers always look at the beginning of the book. Okay, so it's a little tongue in cheek, but it's also true. So Chaim ben Bezalel says, I object to the Ramah. The Ramah is a wonderful contribution to the preservation of the Minhagim of the Jews of Poland. But he says, what about the rest of the Jews who are Ashkenazic? What about the German Jews? He says, go look through the Ramah. You won't find a hint of a German Minhag. Sometimes German and Poland have the same Minhag, so they overlap. But he says, it's wonderful. So, Shkoach, thanks for preserving the Polish Minhag. And what about the German Minhag? So there's an unsettled question. What does it mean to be an Ashkenazic Jew? And we throw around this term as if it just applies to all of us. But it was never clear. It was never clear exactly who should be included in this designation of Ashkenazic Jewry. I'll just conclude with one final source, which did I include it on the source sheet? You have it for in your source sheet on as number 8. Okay, and I'll just summarize it for you. To share, it's such a fascinating historical piece, right? I don't think any of us would have intuited this answer to the question of what makes you an Ashkenazic Jew. The author of the Shaar Ephraim, okay, Ephraim HaKohen, so he's of holds a special place for me because he is the maternal grandfather of Chacham Tzvi, the great-grandfather of Rabbi Yaakov Emden. Chacham Tzvi says when he was a little boy, he used to learn on the lap of his maternal grandfather. Rav Ephraim HaKohen, the author of the Shaar Ephraim, who was the chief rabbi of the town we would today call Budapest. Okay. And he writes the following. He says, I didn't know this when I showed up in this town. He was himself an exile from Moravia and from Vilna. And he showed up in Budapest, which we're in the 1670s or thereabouts. Okay, and in the 1670s, Budapest is under the control of the Ottoman Empire. And he gets to Budapest, and this is an Ottoman community, and it's a Sephardic community. Now, he's not a Sephardic Jew. He's very much an Ashkenazic Jew. And he gets there and he says he found in the Pinkas, the communal record book of the community, he says they took a vote and they decided they didn't want there to be any discord among the members of the community. So they took a vote and they decided that they were going to functionally affiliate with the Sephardic community. They voted themselves out of Ashkenaz. Okay. So who even knew this was possible, right? That a community could just decide, you know, raise your hand if you want to eat rice on Pesach. I'm obviously making a little bit of a joke, but if you want to be Sephardic, so we just vote ourselves out of Ashkenaz and decide we're going to follow the Sephardic community. Okay. So maybe this is possible too, and your identity, right, may not follow your geology, it may not follow your biology, it may follow your volition, right, it may follow the community's decision whether to not join a particular community. Okay, in the final 4 minutes, because we always have to go back to the text, I want to learn a Ramah with you, just so you can see the Ramah in action, and you'll have something to take away when we get to Hanukkah. You'll be prepared with this halacha. So I'll just summarize it for you. But here you have three sources: 9, 10, and 11. The Tur, the Beit Yosef, and the Darkei Moshe. So the Tur says, I just want to let you know what should you use for your fuel for your Hanukkah candles. And he says, Kol hashmanim v'apsilos ksherim la ben b'chol ben b'shabes af ha'psulim l'ner shal shabes b'nei she'ein oron yafe v'she'ein ha'shem nivshach achar ha'psilah ksherim la d'lo chayshin an shema t'chabe V'yachzer v'yadli kenem. It says, it doesn't matter. You know, Shabbos, so you, certain fuels you're supposed to use, and for you're not supposed to use, b'amim adlikin. And he says, when it comes to Hanukkah, doesn't matter. Anything you want, you could use any kind of fuel, doesn't matter. Beit Yosef, Johnny on the spot, source number 10. He says, yeah, we got the tour. The tour says use anything you want, but I want to let you know, third line in source number 10, Baharokeach kasav shemen zayis mitzvah min amuvchar. Really the best thing to use, right? I thought this was like, it's buried in the third line, but no, he says, by the way, just a footnote, best thing to use is olive oil. And I want to let you know, Vagama Mordechai, it's not just the Rokeach, the Mordechai said that. The Mordechai actually wrote, Kasav Maharam, Ayaragil Hadlik B'Shemen Zayas. The Maharam Rotenberg, it's actually quoting, ironically, he's quoting an Ashkenazic source, lets you know that really Shemen Zayas is preferred. Darkei Moshe, right? Darkei Moshe, the Ramah, source number 11. So he has the tour and the Beit Yosef. You're gonna any oil. Tour says any oil you want. Beit Yosef says olive oil is the best. V'chein nahag haril v'amin hakapashut lahadlik b'shabba. He says, but you know what we do here in Krakow? Wax candles. That's what we do. Okay. And he goes on to say, v'yesh kasav b'min hagem d'shava mitzvah min amufchar. Kemo b'shem and zayis. You think olive oil is the best? Olive oil is great, and candles are equally great. Because of Maharenu Reb Avraham Miprag, v'tama ki b'vadai tzalil nehor atzvei mikol ashmanim. He says, you're not going to get a cleaner, nicer flame than with a wax candle. Okay, Uva Kalbo, Yesh Madlikin B'nei Rosh Hashava. He says lots of sources, including the Kalbo, say that you should light with Hanukkah candles. And then at the end, he says, you know, there's one other source that says really Shemen Zayas is better. But, you know, what did the Ramah light? I think he lit wax candles, equally good, right, according to his Ashkenazic sources, which were conveniently totally absent, right? You open up the tour, you open up the Beit Yosef, no mention of, right? I'm saying in the tour said you could use anything you want. Even he didn't mention it. The Beit Yosef says, we all know, we all went to first grade. They told you the mitzvah happened with Shemen Zayit, so you should use Shemen Zayit. And the Ramah says, wonderful, but you know what our minhag is? Our minhag is to use wax candles. So we're just about out of time, and I'm sorry that we're just ending on a abrupt note. I'm happy to stay on and answer any questions or comments, but I'll just conclude with one final note, and that is what's left for us to kind of wrap up and tie together, which I hope to do next time, is to understand how it came to be that the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah actually became authoritative. Right, these were wonderful projects by extraordinarily talented men. That being said, there are many wonderful projects by talented people that come to naught. Or, you know, they write a book and it's a book in the back of the library that no one ever reads. So how did it come to be, right? And this is really the $64,000 question, that Rabbi Yosef Karo and Rabbi Moshe Isserles became the central, almost kind of undisputed authorities for, right, the next 400-500 years, ad hayom hazeh, right, including all the commentaries that we think about, the Aruch HaShulchan and the Mishnah Berurah, they're all based around the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. How did that happen? So please, God, invite you to join us next week at this time. We'll try to answer that very question. So I'm going to stop the recording now, but happy to stay on and take any questions or comments. And thank you to one and all for joining us this evening.
Thank you, Fess.